Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening statewide to the Civic Media Radio Network. We've been talking a little bit about Donald Trump's hush money trial, what I call the voter manipulation criminal trial in New York City. Judge Juan Marchand not taking any crap from the former president or his lawyers. Came out of the box pretty hot yesterday. Couple of key rulings. Rejected a request from Trump's lawyers that he be excused from trial proceedings to attend his immunity arguments before the Supreme Court. The judge said, having your day in the U.S. Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court is a big deal. But facing trial in New York County, also a big deal, you know, one would think. No, his lawyers cannot have an extra day to file paperwork that they should have filed 2 months ago. And meh, you might not be able to go see Barron Trump's high school graduation. Judge Marchand said, it really depends on if we are on time and where we are in the trial, which is interesting. Like, hey, if your lawyers would stop delaying things and we could get on with this, maybe you could go to the high school graduation. But seeing how things have been going thus far, I deem that highly unlikely. And, you know, hi, Sleepy Don. This is what happens to regular people when we end up in criminal trouble. We can't go to all of our family events.
I was just thinking, like, how many millions of Americans missed funerals, graduations, weddings, parties, because they had something way, way less like than these however many felony counts of trying to overthrow the government. Like, yeah, this is what happens when you get in trouble. It disrupts your personal life.
Yes.
Oof.
Yes. And this one, I do want to correct the record because I misspoke last segment. I said 43 felony counts. This is in the New York State criminal trial that's happening in Manhattan. 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to engage in a cover-up, which was a cover-up to manipulate voters. Hence why I call it not just the hush money trial. It's not about, I mean, I think most of us would be like, what? Paying off somebody so your wife doesn't find out that you cheated. Maybe you don't go to prison for that. But doing it to cover up not just the affair, but then lying and falsifying business records to cover up the cover up, to keep it from the American public when your presidential election is 5 weeks away. That's what the crime is, because you're manipulating voters. Also, Trump's lawyer, a guy by the name of Todd Blanche, tried to squeeze out, again, this is for the Supreme Court date next week, and said at one point, we aren't even supposed to be here. And Judge Marchand lit him up in response to that. You're like, yes, you are supposed to be here because your client's in a criminal case. I also wanted to be clear. Yesterday, basically, they had nearly 100 potential jurors, threw out more than half of them, and only 6 jurors made it through the 42-question jury questionnaire without getting tossed by the end of the day. I was sharing with everybody a few of those questions. We're going to have many witnesses, 42 names on the witness list, every member of Trump's family, the prominent members, Steve Bannon, Rudy Giuliani, Michael Cohen, Kellyanne Conway, media executives David Pecker and Dylan Howard. These are the guys that came up with the catch and kill. In other words, the media outlet pays the person for their story and then never runs the story. That's what they did with Stormy Daniels, arguably at Michael Cohen's direction, who is acting at Donald Trump's direction. Donald Trump said things like, looks like the judge won't let me to go to the graduation of my son, who's worked very, very hard. I've been looking forward to his graduation for years. Looks like the judge will not allow me to escape the scam trial. Ugh. And he called it a political persecution. And of course, what's going on? Now there are more motions filed by prosecutors to fine Donald Trump for violating the gag order, which was supposed to prevent him from saying things like that. It's sort of, don't you feel a little bit like it's deja vu? You know, what did Yogi Berra call deja vu? Somebody remind me. It's like, I think I'm having this feeling and thinking it all over again. I can't remember the Yogi Berra quote about it's deja vu all over again. Something like that. I think that's it.
Just as I pulled it up, you found it. There you go.
It was in the mental recesses. Deja vu all over again. Yes, it feels like deja vu. Same thing with the gag order in the New York State civil case, also about fraud. But most notably, Trump seemed to nod off both in the morning session and in the afternoon session, jolted awake. The afternoon, he literally was like stock still for about 3 minutes with his eyes closed and his arms crossed tightly across his chest. And then his head sort of drifted over to one side like you do when you fall asleep. But then he popped up, acted real ticked off. But yeah, Sleepy Don, not a good look. Not a good look. I liked this one. This was Rachel Maddow's description of it. Yes, the wheels of justice have moved slowly, but apparently so slowly that they have rocked the defendant to sleep. I thought that was a good description. And of course, the right wing freaking out about him falling asleep. I wouldn't deny it, really. If any of you have been in a courtroom, and I'll attest to this, a lot of this stuff is dry, mechanical, repetitive logistics. Not every lawyer is an engaging speaker, though you would think it just the opposite. No, some of them are, and it just goes on and on. Listen, Sleepy Don, you should probably stay awake during your criminal trial. I would advise staying awake, but I get it. A lot of the stuff that happens in courtrooms is really boring. You only see the sexy stuff on Law and Order. By the way, Law and Order, not a real depiction of police or lawyers or defense attorneys or courtroom processes. Forget Law and Order. Stop using it as a reference point. It's not a reference point. It doesn't work like that. Okay, my Law and Order diatribe. Now done. Yeah, so it's just, it's been an interesting day and a half. Again, Jeff from Shorewood sharing with us that according to NBC, six jurors out of a 12-juror jury have been seated. Fascinating. Here's other explanations for Donald Trump falling asleep in court. I call it, I was inspecting the inside of my eyelids. They could use that one.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I'm sure he was meditating.
Resting his eyes.
Yes. Sustained eye rest. The meditating, I think that one would be good. When I think of meditation, guess who pops right into my head? Donald J. Trump. Yes. Yeah. He seems very meditative.
I'm actually amazed he didn't claim he was praying.
Oh.
Wouldn't that have...
Now you just willed it into the universe.
I'm so sorry. This is why I won't ever work for the other side. I'm too good. I got too many good ideas.
Oh, that is it. I had my eyes closed in reverent prayer. Okay, in other Trump legal news, and I can't pass this one up because it is a kind of a big deal, the Supreme Court today heard arguments. We're going to listen to a couple of the back and forth because they're fascinating little tidbits. And what the Supreme Court heard arguments regarding is one of the charges that has been leveled, criminal charges that has been leveled against many, many of the January 6th rioters and insurrectionists. To date, more than 1,380 people have been charged in connection with January 6th. Among the most common charges against them are two misdemeanors, illegal parading inside the Capitol and entering and remaining in a restricted federal area, a type of trespassing. The Supreme Court case today has nothing to do with those two charges. Those are the most common ones. But about 350 of the rioters have been accused of violating the obstruction statute that is at the root of the Supreme Court's oral argument today. And many, many people have been charged with numerous different federal crimes. By the way, 800 defendants to date have already pleaded guilty. 250 of them have done so to felony charges. More than 150 defendants have been convicted at trial, and only two have been fully acquitted. More than 850 people have been sentenced so far, and about 520 have received at least some time in prison. So the federal statute at the root of today's Supreme Court arguments is 18 U.S.C. 1512, section 1512 sub C. And I'm going to read it to you. Don't worry, we won't get lost in the wonk. I'll help you all understand it, because the argument is super fascinating. Here is the statute. This is 18 U.S.C. section 1512. Whoever corruptly alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a record, document, or other object, or attempts to do so with the intent to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding. Okay? Think destroying evidence, right? And then there's sub two. Whoever corruptly otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding or attempts to do so shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both. So the first part focuses basically on evidence tampering. And evidence tampering with the purpose of affecting, interfering with an official proceeding. The second one is to otherwise do so. This all comes down to what does the word corruptly and what does the word otherwise mean? Of course, that's what the Supreme Court's going to be arguing about. Don't you worry. I won't let us get lost in the details. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network statewide. Keep it locked, everybody. I'm going to continue to break this down. Incredibly important Supreme Court arguments heard earlier today. We've got some of that sound coming up for you. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after these important messages.
First plane. I'll see the veins of my city like they do.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm talking about the Supreme Court arguments heard earlier this morning. If you've got questions or comments, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Most importantly, we're talking about one of the particular charges. It's basically obstructing a proceeding of Congress that a lot of the January 6th defendants have been charged with. It's not the dominant charge. Many have been charged with numerous offenses. This is but one of them. Again, other charges. And the two most frequent charges are illegal parading inside the Capitol and basically trespassing. Two separate charges, okay? But there's this question about what does 18 U.S.A. 1512 sub C mean when it says it's a crime to corruptly otherwise obstruct, influence, impede any official proceeding or attempt to do so? And the otherwise is in reference to the prior subsection that talks about altering, destroying, mutilates, or conceals a record, document, or other object. What does all that mean? Now, point of note, where did this statute come from? Enron. Something I know a wee bit about. And specifically what happened in Enron is that Arthur Anderson, people refer this to the Arthur Anderson loophole. If you've been around since the Enron scandal, you will recall that Arthur Anderson was Enron's auditors. And basically, they shredded millions of documents. And nobody could figure out if that was in and of itself a crime. And so, excuse me. And so this statute came about, and they added this provision that was the catch-all. That's the, other than actually shredding the documents, which you know are going to be needed in an official proceeding, so congressional probes, what have you. What does the otherwise obstructs or influences or impedes any official proceeding mean? So there were two really interesting, and by the way, the guy that is at the root of this case is a gentleman by the name of Joseph Fisher of rural Pennsylvania. By the way, he's a former police officer. Not to be confused with the other January 6th defendant named Joseph Fisher of Plymouth, Massachusetts, also a former police officer. And no, folks, you didn't hear that incorrectly. Two Joseph Fishers, criminal defendants and former police officers. That's how crazy this got. Okay. This Joseph Fisher guy from rural Pennsylvania. And he got charged also. This isn't his only charge. He's also charged with basically assaulting a police officer, disorderly conduct in the Capitol, trespassing, some other stuff. So even if this count gets tossed, he'll still face criminal charges. And the root of the argument that's being made by Mr. Fisher's lawyers is this isn't about like physical assault on the Capitol. That's not what they mean by otherwise obstructing an official proceeding. That otherwise is still in reference to basically it has to be about documents somehow. So Mr. Fisher could only be charged if he took documents or shredded documents or altered documents. And it gets really wonky. But there was this fascinating exchange. So we're going to listen to the Clarence Thomas cut back and forth. There's this really interesting exchange between Justice Clarence Thomas and the United States Solicitor General, Solicitor General Prelogar, Elizabeth Prelogar. And what Thomas is asking her is, has the government ever used this statute before to criminally prosecute someone for disrupting a congressional proceeding like this? Let's take a listen.
Has the government applied this provision to other protests in the past? And has this been the government's position throughout the lifespan of the statute?
It has certainly been the government's position since the enactment of 1512C2 that it covers the myriad forms of obstructing an official proceeding and that it's not limited to some kind of evidence impairment gloss.
Have you enforced it in that manner?
We have enforced it in a variety of prosecutions that don't focus on evidence tampering. Now, I can't give you an example of enforcing it in a situation where people have violently stormed a building in order to prevent an official proceeding, a specified one, from occurring with all of the elements like intent to obstruct, knowledge of the proceeding, having the corruptly mens rea, but that's just because I'm not aware of that circumstance ever happening prior to January 6th.
So His lawyers are trying to argue that this has to basically just do with evidence tampering. They also make some arguments that the corrupt intent means that you have to be trying to obtain an unlawful benefit, either financial, professional, or exculpatory advantage. But what's interesting there is Clarence Thomas is asking her, like, have you enforced it this way before? And in part, she says, yes, we've used it in cases that don't involve tampering with evidence. But no, Justice, we've never had to use this to prosecute insurrectionists because there's not been an insurrection before, sir. Fascinating moment. Now, I think we might have time for this next clip. This is Justice Sotomayor and Trump's lawyer, a guy by the name of Green, talking about whether or not this subsection is superfluous, meaning extraneous, additive, don't need it, it's covered elsewhere. Let's take a listen.
all of the different provisions in Section 1512, 15 of the 21 would be subsumed by the government's reading of C2. And the government's reading of C2, I remind the court, is so broad that it would cover anyone who does something understanding that what they are doing is wrong in some way, that in any way influence, impedes, or obstructs an official proceeding of any type.
Well, Mr. Green,
maybe
I think
limited
this,
by federal.
There's a good case that this provision, everybody knew it was going to be superfluous because it was a provision that was meant to function as a backstop. Superfluity is very often a good argument when it comes to statutory interpretation, but it's not a good argument when Congress is specifically devising a backstop provision to fill gaps that might exist. They don't exactly know how they exist, but they think that they probably do exist in a pre-existing statutory scheme, and that's what this provision is intended to do.
So first of all, like, big snaps for Justice Sotomayor. I wrote down superfluidity. That's a new one. Again, we'll play that back when we come back after these messages, and I'm going to explain to you what it means and what this case might actually be about. You may be surprised to hear what my opinion on it is. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. The 2 hours have flown by. We're coming up on our last half hour. If you want to get in on the discussion, you got questions, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Don't go anywhere. Your farm update is up next. Let's go down to the tennis court and talk it up like, yeah. It looks alright in the pictures. Get it caught tight for the trip, though. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join the conversation. You got questions? I might have answers. I'll try to have answers. And if I don't know the answers, I'll go look them up. 855-752-4842. Talking this portion of the show about a very fascinating Supreme Court case, oral arguments heard this morning. This case has to deal with one particular charge brought against some of the January 6th criminal defendants, now numbering well over, 1,380 people. The charge at that's being questioned before the Supreme Court, in other words, whether or not this actually applies to the actions undertaken by the rioters on January 6th, this is not the most common charge. The most common charges are two different sorts of trespassing, if you will, parading without permission in the Capitol and trespassing. That's by far what's most common. This is a charge that is obstructing a federal proceeding. Here, obstructing the counting of electoral votes. It comes under 18 U.S.C. 1512. And the first portion of this is basically an evidence tampering crime. Whoever corruptly destroys, mutilates a record with the intent to make it unavailable for a congressional proceeding is guilty of a crime. And then the second portion says, if you corruptly otherwise obstruct, influence, or impede an official federal proceeding or attempts to do so, is also guilty of a crime. So the question is, what does that second part mean? Was it intended to apply to this sort of activity? And how broad is its reach? And one of the arguments that Trump's lawyers have put forward, amongst others, are that it's too broad. And oh, by the way, if it means what the federal government is arguing it to mean, then it duplicates all sorts of other provisions in this statute. So we're going to listen one more time to this back and forth between Justice Sotomayor and Attorney Green, counsel for not Donald Trump. I think I said that wrongly. Counsel for the defendant, Mr. Fisher, in this case.
All of the different provisions in Section 1512, 15 of the 21 would be subsumed by the government's reading of C2. And the government's reading of C2, I would remind the court, is so broad that it would cover anyone who does something understanding that what they are doing is wrong in some way, that in any way influence, impedes, or obstructs an official proceeding of any type.
Well, Mr. Green,
maybe
I think
limited
this,
by federal.
There's a good case that this provision, everybody knew it was going to be superfluous because it was a provision that was meant to function as a backstop. Superfluity is very often a good argument when it comes to statutory interpretation. But it's not a good argument when Congress is specifically devising a backstop provision to fill gaps that might exist. They don't exactly know how they exist, but they think that they probably do exist in a pre-existing statutory scheme. And that's what this provision is intended to do.
So what they're saying there is, very generally, when you're reading statutes, you assume that lawmakers aren't trying to duplicate. In other words, you're not going to have in a single statutory scheme or in a single statutory chapter, you're not going to have three provisions that all make the same action criminal or that describe the same crime. And so Attorney Green is making a decent argument, but what Justice Sotomayor is pointing out is that in the wake of Enron, the federal government was concerned about, we know that there's other actions out there that this statutory scheme hasn't yet reached, and so we need a catch-all. Right? That's why there's this otherwise language. Now, again, there are some really semantic, super detailed arguments about, well, actually, otherwise here doesn't mean otherwise. It means similar to, because in this other case with a sort of similar statute, it was interpreted to mean similar to. I'm not going to get into all that because it's just too nerdy. I don't think that's a plain reading of the word otherwise. Otherwise means, yet, not the stuff that was just listed there. So I don't think it has to be a crime that involves destroying documents or evidence. But what concerns me here is, well, doesn't a valid exercise of my First Amendment rights in many circumstances potentially have the impact to obstruct a proceeding? That protests could obstruct a proceeding. Now, I think that criminal prosecutors exercising responsible prosecutorial discretion would not use it in that way. And in fact, there's a bit of a discussion about that. And Solicitor General Elizabeth Pregelar makes that point. She says, being asked about this, she says, listen, a peaceful protest, even one that was quite disruptive, doesn't qualify for prosecution under the statute. But the question of, well, what type, when does a political protest turn into a riot? And the statute requires effectively criminal intent. That's the corruptly part. So, you know, I find myself kind of at equipoise. I can make very good arguments on both sides of whether or not this federal law was applied in an appropriate way. And the question here is the vagueness. And listen, the vagueness and the overlapping, and yes, it's covered by other statutes, but how? That is not really a question that's disputed. Most folks that have to interpret this section of code and federal prosecutors agree that we've got kind of a morass here. But I think if there was ever any activity or behavior that should be prosecutable under this provision, it's this, right? Well, Your Honor, in part my response to this line of questioning, if I were arguing to the Supreme Court, is this isn't that. In other words, this federal law, if applied in that way, to prosecute what should be protected First Amendment speech, that case will come before you again. That's not the case here. This was applied in conformity with the plain language reading of the statute to the most extreme sort of behavior, which unquestionably and clearly, within any reading of the plain language of this criminal statute, this behavior is prosecutable under 18 U.S.C. 1512 sub C sub 2. If it ain't this, it's nothing, and that statute has to come off the books. That's effectively what my argument would be. Now, again, as a free speech advocate, I get concerned that if you had an agendized prosecutor who had predetermined what the outcome should be, or was, say, really anti-Black Lives Matter movements, right? Or didn't want to hear from folks protesting what is occurring in Gaza. It could be used in a way that would potentially run up against the First Amendment. But these actions weren't that. The corrupt intent here, and by the way, there are facts in this guy's case. There are text messages that the feds uncovered a long time ago that showed that he wanted the vote to stop. According to court papers, Mr. Fisher was concerned about his job before making the trip to Washington. Investigators unearthed text messages that he wrote to the chief of his police department, because this guy's a former cop, saying that things could get, quote, violent on January 6th and that the crowd should, quote, storm the Capitol and drag out all the Democrats. Democrats, paren sick. He spelled Democrat, Democrat. So he knew what he was going to do. We're going to be violent. We're going to drag out the Democrats. So, yes, the evidence of his criminal intent here is plain. And so if this ain't what you prosecute with that provision, then what is it? I just don't know. And words have to have meanings. And Congress is presumed, legislatures are presumed to know what they were doing when they enacted laws. So you can't just read this into a nullity, meaning you can't just render it into oblivion, unless the Supreme Court wants to declare the statute unconstitutional. But that's not the challenges as I understand them. So I just think this is one of those very fascinating legal cases that is moving along that could have some further implications, right? And I would also say this. Donald Trump is charged under this statute. So if it doesn't mean this, one may be thinking, ooh, whoa. Do those charges against Trump go away? I'm certain that if the court rules that it can't be applied in the way that 18 U.S.C. 1512 sub C sub 2 was applied to Mr. Fisher, I'm sure Donald Trump's lawyers will argue that those charges against him should also be dismissed. But here's the catch when it comes to Trump. There was a fake slate of electors that he was advocating to be used. Arguably, that's distorting evidence or documents in a way to try to obstruct a proceeding, right? So there's actual documentary arguments that can be made for relative to President Trump's criminal charges arising from the same federal law. So I don't think that it makes it go away for Donald Trump. Our good friend Mark pointing out the fact that it's a little odd that Clarence Thomas has yet again refused to recuse himself from this case when his wife was texting Mark Meadows, basically trying to get him to use the fake slate of electors and to further foment this sort of insurrection and interruption of this congressional proceeding. Interesting, isn't it? Unseemly, distasteful, absurd even. Yeah, I think it's a problem. I wouldn't want to. Would you, if you're a criminal defendant, or the victim of a crime and the wife or husband of the judge overseeing your case was somehow involved in this crime, alleged crime, would you want that judge overseeing your case? I mean, forget who this is. It's like, oh, hell no. Of course not. And yet, somehow we can't find our way to put in place a known conflict of interest law that governs Supreme Court ethics. Hello, Congress. It's me, Margaret. I would really like a Supreme Court code of ethics enshrined in federal law. Please do that. Hi, Vey. When we come back, I'm going to talk about multitasking. Because that's what I feel like my brain has been doing all day, is multitasking over all these myriad legal issues surrounding Donald Trump. I'm Maggie Dawn. We'll be back with more in a bit. We're going to talk about multitasking. Do you do it? How does it work for you? Do you feel like you get more done or less done? 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. In this day of multitasking amongst all Donald Trump's criminal prosecutions, how do we keep it straight? That question up next on The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep on running because the winner don't quit on themselves. Welcome back, Wisconsin. It is the last segment of the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm going to talk a little bit about multitasking. If you're a multitasker, if you think you multitask well, I would love to hear from you. 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. I have always worn multiple hats. And every day in my new work here at Civic Media, I'm both their general counsel and I do this lovely show with Anya and all of you wonderful people. And so within the course of a workday, I'm wearing two hats. And I feel like I try to do sometimes two or three things at once. Manage my email, get some articles printed for the show, get a show outline going. And this piece came out in the New York Times about, it's called A Multitasker's Guide to Regaining Focus. And I gave a read on it because I thought, boy, this is the modern state, isn't it? And I think a lot of us talk about, oh, I'm a great multitasker. Is that really true? Are we good multitaskers? And I struggled to try to keep my focus doing one thing at a time. And I think over the course of my life as a student first, and then in my career, my ability to work for long periods of time on one thing, really sustained attention, was an incredibly helpful skill that I had on really dense, complicated stuff, or even simple things, but a lot of them back to back to back. And I thought I wanted to share this with you because I feel like, especially even in our news cycles, it requires, we'll be bouncing from this thing to the next thing, and there's so much happening. It's why one of the things that Anya and I try to do on a day-over-day basis is share with you the connections between things. Right, today we talked about getting aid to Ukraine. We talked about the voter manipulation criminal case that Donald Trump is facing in New York. And we ended by talking about a legal challenge to a particular charge brought against the January 6th rioters. Well, there's a thread there. It's the influence of Donald Trump in all matters, in nearly all corners of our U.S. political discourse. And it all that stuff matters today. As much as we get sick of it, right? It's where we're at. But since, again, starting my job with Civic, I now, on many days of the week, and from around the first month and a half, every day, commuted from Milwaukee out to Waukesha. And I would take phone calls en route. Can you really do that? Can you drive and talk on the phone? Do you text when you're sitting at a red light? Do we do those things? Do you listen to a podcast while you're doing chores? Do you take phone calls while you're cooking? Do you go between your email inbox at work and reading news or trying to write a report? Like, are we doing all these different things at once? And the reason is, at base, all of us avoid boredom. None of us wants to be bored. Americans, especially, I think we kind of fear boredom. I know now, if you see someone, Anya, when's the last time you saw someone sitting there at a, like, in a line, at a restaurant, in any sort of queue, of course, doing nothing, no phone in hand, just standing or sitting there?
See, I wouldn't see them because I'm on my phone. That's my problem.
There you go. Well, it's not your problem. It's a collective. It's our problem. But you don't see people doing nothing. Now, when I lived in New York, I was a subway rider. You would see people doing nothing on the subway, just sitting there, resting. I don't think that's probably true anymore. Even though you don't get service in a lot of the places, they've got stuff loaded. You're kindling, you know, whatever it is. And I usually had a book with me in my bag. It's sort of the New Yorker's bag will have the following items in it: bottle of water, hard copy book, perhaps, and maybe this is just antiquated, a map, a snack of some sort, lest you get stuck on the subway for multiple hours, and probably about at least $100 in cash, because New York is still very much a cash type economy. But here was the point of the article. Zero people can do more than one thing at once. Zero. None of us can do more than one thing at once. Our brains really can only do one thing at a time. And so what happens as we're flipping between tasks is what economists would sort of call transactional costs. Because your brain has to, okay, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm doing this other thing now. And if those tasks or one of them is a complicated task, it takes your brain even longer to sort of get in and back out of that groove. And so when we're quote unquote multitasking, what we're doing is doing one thing and then bumping to another and then coming back and then we're doing this other thing and then we go back. You're really only doing one thing at a time. But what you lose is your momentum and your precision in what you're doing. Of course, you can also get in a car accident. You're talking on the phone, right? And driving. And you also lose memory. Because when you're flipping between things, it's like you can kind of think of it as the central processing unit of a computer. And what we're using up is our short-term memory. And so if we're flipping between three or four things, our brain is trying to hold on to, like, oh, here's where I was in that thing. So now I'm going over to this other thing. And back and forth we go. And the more overloaded we get, the more we try to keep in our brains at once, the more fatigued we feel mentally and then physically, right? And we can increase our heart rates. Our blood pressure goes up. We get anxious. We feel sometimes depressed. We start to hate our work if our work is asking us to do all these different things at once. So I ask us to maybe in this next week, let's all try to just do one thing at a time as best we can. Because it's good for you and it's good for me and it's good for how you're going to feel. I'm Maggie Dawn. It's been a real pleasure this afternoon. You have all been my guests and my participants, my partners in this discussion, as well as Anya Esther, always and ever. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'll be back tomorrow with some good news and, you know, some challenging news. We'll talk about Megan Wolf and the death threats she's receiving. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but it's always better when we stand together. That's it for this Monday episode of The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network.